Okay, I think we're going to go ahead and get started with the program. Our speakers only ask for about 20 minutes, but based off the topic, I will be surprised if we don't have lots and lots of questions for him. As Peg mentioned, our speaker today, Paul Harvey, is with us, and in addition to the awards that Peg mentioned that he won, also I think worth noting that he is also the 2008 recipient of the Outstanding Teacher Award that the University Club grants. So your dues go directly to that award, and so we always like to have the recipient come in and speak to us. So not that we wouldn't want him other way, but that's just another great reason to have him in the room today. A little bit about Paul. He is a researcher and a writer in the field of post-Civil War American history. Particular interests include Southern history, American religious history, popular culture, war and society, and the history of American music. He's an author, an editor, and he also runs the only web blog specifically devoted to American religious history. Today, his presentation is on religion and politics in presidential elections. Again, 20 minutes on that. I'm not sure exactly how we're going to pull that off, but if nothing else, again, I would expect we'll have a great amount of questions. So please welcome our speaker, Paul Harvey.
As a historian, whenever I ask students why they're supposed to study history, they usually say some variant of, so we will learn the mistakes of the past and not repeat them. And I rarely restrain my smart aleck side in class, and so I usually say, well, then we just go on to invent our own mistakes, don't we? But I don't disagree with the quote entirely, that quote coming famously from George Santayana. I do find the cliche a little bit annoying at times, since, of course, so many of the so-called lessons of history are, in fact, contradictory. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, the contradictory lessons of religion and politics and presidential elections, which I'm going to address from the historical perspectives. So we're not going to get anyone riled up with the current-day partisan politics. I'll talk a lot about 1800 and things, election and things like that. So I'm going to start with a couple of different statements, both of which are true, and both of which contradict each other, and both of which come out of the experience of religion and politics in American history. The first, in America, religion and politics are and should be separate. The second, religion and politics have never been and should not be separate. Over the last generation or so, we've had our own culture wars raging. And it's often pointed out that the red state, blue state divide mimics maps of religious geography that you could draw up. And this has, in fact, been the case for much of American history. So what I'm starting out with here is, this is something I put up on my web blog called Religion in American History some time ago. And it was a project I was involved in of mapping America's religious geography, and we had a series of 8 books that came from looking at different regional parts of the country and the various religious geographies that come out of it. And so my part of the project was on a book about the South called, and it was about the Evangelical Belt. And the book on the Pacific Northwest, Seattle and so forth, was called The Nuns. That is, those who say they have no religion are the predominant group in the Pacific Northwest. Obviously not the group in the American South. So I asked the question, is the South still a cultural region? What you see there is a map in which the red indicates where Baptist churches outnumber all other religious bodies. And it also indicates a certain kind of political region of the country, that is to say, where certain kinds of political candidates draw a great deal of their support. And what I wanted to contrast that with is a second map. So this is the map from 2000. This is the map of the 1800 election with Thomas Jefferson versus John Adams. And what you see here is the part in orange, which is basically Adams' base of support, that is the evangelical belt of 1800 who vote for the Federalist Party. The part in the blue there, which includes what was then the American South, that's the anti-religious belt in the 1800 election who came out to vote for Thomas Jefferson in part because of his stance for religion, separation of religion and state. I should say the Baptists also came out to vote for him, but actually precisely for the same reason. And so when you look at the map of 1800 and the religious geography in terms of its voting patterns, and you contrast it with that map, you see that there's a complete transformation of American religious and political geography. And one of the things I've done in my academic career is to try to figure out how do you get from there to there over the course of 200 years. One thing I like to do in class in American religious history is to read a series of quotes without telling, and say these are quotes from presidential candidates. And would you vote for this presidential candidate? One of them comes from Thomas Jefferson, who says that someday the myths of the Bible will be classed with the myths of Minerva. In other words, the myths of the ancient world. Interesting stories that are not true, but are interesting as stories only. And some other quotes from James Madison and others. And then I'll say, would you vote for this person? Generally, nobody would vote for them except sometimes for one long-haired young man in the back row, often with a backwards baseball cap on, who has to be the contrarian in the class. And then at the end of that exercise, I'll say, what you all just did is you voted against the entire generation of founding fathers, almost the entire generation of founding fathers, John Adams maybe being excepted. And then we'll talk about why we have a sort of de facto religious test for candidates that was not the case 200 years ago and is in fact expressly prohibited by the Constitution. The reason for this contradiction has to do with a lot of things, but I'll point here to a coincidence of two of them. First, the ratification of the secular Constitution in 1789, followed closely by the Second Great Awakening and the rapid rise of evangelicalism as a dominant form of American religious expression. The first, the secular constitution, what one historian calls the godless constitution, foresaw a tight regulation of religion and politics, or even a complete elimination of it, as some founding fathers would have preferred, certainly Thomas Jefferson would have preferred. The second, the Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, made such a separation of religion and politics in American history impossible. Thus, we have a de jure separation of church and state and a de jure notion of the separation of the religious from the political, but historically we've had a profound intermingling of the two. When the founders framed the Constitution in 1789, many of them assumed that while there would certainly be no established form of religion nationally, there might be some safely regulated state establishments such as the Congregationalist Church in Connecticut. The Congregationalist Church in New England was famously described as the Federalist Party at prayer, much like the Anglican establishment in England was the Tory Party at prayer. Others, like Thomas Jefferson, assumed that freedom of religion would naturally and inevitably lead to the rise of rational religion in America and the decline of what Jefferson called priestcraft and superstition, by which he meant the Presbyterians would have no influence whatsoever. The Age of the Enlightenment, Jefferson foresaw, and the new Democratic Republic of America would ensure, he thought, the final elimination of what he called religious superstition from politics. So these two forces, the Federalist idea and the Jeffersonian idea, famously clashed in 1800 when Jefferson ran for president and won in what he later referred to as the Revolution of 1800. Jefferson's political base lay in the countryside, in the South, and amongst all those who opposed Northeastern Federalist power. The Federalists, strongest in the Northeast, unleashed a fusillade of attacks against Jefferson that make our political campaign seem very tame by comparison. For example, the president of Yale University, Timothy Dwight, led the culture war against Jefferson. Famously, on July 4, 1800, Dwight said that the election of Jefferson would lead to churches becoming temples of reason. And he was referring to the temples of reason in the French Revolution of that era, where the Catholic churches are turned into secular temples of rationality. And he thought that Jefferson would force everyone to cast their Bibles into a bonfire. A flagship Federalist paper asked the question, to be asked by every American, shall I continue in allegiance to God and a religious president, John Adams, or shall I impiously declare for Jefferson and no God? Another paper said, murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will all be openly taught and practiced under Jefferson's administration. A Federalist woman took her Bible to the home of a Jefferson supporter and said, my Bible will be perfectly safe with you. They'll never think of looking for it in the house of a Democrat. Jefferson won the election, just barely, and ironically, he had the Baptists to thank for it. Baptists had allied with Jefferson and Madison to pass the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, for example, and that their vote probably swayed the election towards Jefferson. Ultimately, both the Federalists and the Jeffersonians were both wrong, for no one foresaw what was in fact coming. The Federalist establishment was wrong. They didn't foresee that their state religious establishments would quickly crumble, and that, in fact, the Congregationalist churches would become centers of Unitarianism and religious liberalism. That's why we now have that famous saying that the Unitarians believed in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the neighborhood of Boston. But the ideas of the Federalist for what would constitute a proper political and religious order were pretty much dead by the 1820s and 1830s, pretty much killed off by the Second Great Awakening. Jefferson was wrong too, though. He thought the First Amendment would free up a nation of freethinkers who would reject the superstitions of the past. He was famously anti-clerical, particularly against Presbyterian ministers, whom he considered equally as guilty as priestcraft as were Roman Catholic priests. But here was his problem. The religious freedom of the early years of the American Republic led to the explosion of the very forms of religious belief and practices that Jefferson detested. The Second Great Awakening of the early and mid-19th century implanted evangelicalism, especially in the Baptist, Methodist, and most horrific of all for Jefferson's thought, Presbyterian revivalist variety, as the dominant form of American Protestantism. And one thing about the evangelicals of that era, they were not about to leave political and religious issues separate. They organized temperance and women's suffrage societies, prison reform societies, and created hundreds of new religious groups and utopian societies, and eventually empowered the abolitionist movement. In the South, evangelicals transformed the Southern view of slavery, which once had been that slavery was a necessary evil handed down to us by our fathers, but one which would have to fade away eventually. And they came up with a positive good interpretation of slavery, which held that slavery brought the word of Christ to those who otherwise would have languished as heathens. Recently, American political historians have had a sort of a field day doing computer analyses of electoral returns through the antebellum era and trying to figure out why did people vote for who they voted for. And basically, here's the answer. People voted for who they voted for religious reasons. The pietists voted one way, the liturgicals another. The pietists were largely Federalists and Whigs. The liturgicals were largely Democrats. The pietists, many of whom had a Calvinist sensibility, believed in the religious improvement of society and using a sort of alliance of government and religious institutions to bring the kingdom of God on earth. And so the Whig Party, representing the pietists, would stand for better roads, better transportation, better education, better churches, and turning everyone into good Protestant citizens. The liturgicals typically believed that the spheres of government and religion should be much more separate, and that attempts to bring about the millennium presupposed a religious activism that went outside the sphere of religion. So the liturgical stood for political ideas that we would now think of as conservative. That's a rough distinction, of course. There's sectional variables. Before the Civil War, slavery threw everything into disarray, so it doesn't quite work as well right before the Civil War. But even after the Civil War, patterns of religious geography were hugely influential in national politics. Here's one thing that tended to happen. Catholics voted one way, typically Democratic, Protestants another, typically Republican, except in the South where there were no Republicans. Big exception there. But generally speaking, Northern Protestants voted Republican. Catholics everywhere typically voted Democrat. That's why, for example, it was crucial in the presidential election of 1884 to taint the candidate Grover Cleveland with that famous phrase, rum, Romanism, and rebellion. His Republican opponent said, a campaign speaker for his Republican opponent, James Blaine, said, "We are Republicans and don't propose to leave our party and identify ourselves with a party whose antecedents have been Romanism and rebellion." The Republican candidate, James Blaine, somehow didn't hear that, and a reporter assigned by the Democrats to cover the meeting eagerly reported the mistake to the Democratic headquarters. When asked if Blaine had meant this remark, the reporter replied that Blaine had made no reference to it. The Democrats then spread the quote all over New York City and elsewhere. By the time Blaine got around to saying, "No, I didn't say that. No, I don't believe in Romanism and rebellion," it was too late. The Irish Catholics came out and voted against him in huge numbers. So Romanism and rebellion, tainting the Democrats as the party opposed to temperance, as the party of Roman Catholics, as the party that led the South into secession, turned out to completely backfire on the Republicans. However, such a campaign proved hugely effective in 1928. As the Democratic candidate from New York, Al Smith, was tainted with the charges that he would follow the Pope. In that case, the propaganda proved so effective that many Southern Democrats switched their votes, really for the only time until the 1970s, to the Republicans, giving Herbert Hoover, the Protestant candidate as they saw it, an overwhelming victory. A couple of other more recent instances. As you all know, Kennedy in 1960 famously delivered a speech to Southern Baptist ministers in Houston, basically saying, "Religion and politics are separate, and you have no reason to fear that my Catholicism will influence my policies at all. I will not take my orders from the Pope," and so on and so forth. In effect, what he said was, "I am a Jeffersonian." In the last primary election with the Republicans, a lot of people were contrasting that speech with the speech given by Mitt Romney. So Kennedy had to deal with his Catholicism, and he did so effectively. Mitt Romney had to deal with his Mormonism. At the time, it was thought that Mitt Romney was the leading candidate for that primary. Of course, as it turned out, that didn't work out that way. But he had, as the leading candidate, he had to dispel fears about Mormonism. And so he gave a speech that everyone assumed would be his Kennedy moment. What was fascinating about that speech, though, is that it was compared to Kennedy's, but it was precisely the opposite of what Kennedy said. Kennedy's speech was about the separation of religion and politics, the historic Jeffersonian position. Romney's was about how faith must influence politics, more or less the historic Federalist position. So here's what Kennedy said. He said, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any ecclesiastical source, and where no religious body seeks to impose its will directly or indirectly upon the general populace or the public acts of its official, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all." Contrast that with Mitt Romney, who said, "The founders prescribed the establishment of a state religion, but they did not countenance the elimination of religion from the public square. We are a nation under God, and in God we do indeed trust. We should acknowledge the Creator, as did our founders, in ceremony and word. He should remain on our currency, in our pledge, in the teaching of our history. And during the holiday season, nativity scenes and menorah should be welcome in all of our public places. Our greatness would not long endure without judges who respect the foundation of faith upon which our Constitution rests. I will take care to separate the affairs of government from any religion, but I will not separate us from the God who gave us liberty." and the last sentence there being almost precisely what the Federalists said in 1800. Finally, a couple of words about religion and the culture wars and religion in recent presidential elections. I should say I wrote this in the fall of 2008 before the last election, so we can talk about the last election if you want, but this is, so think about yourselves in September 2008. What we're seeing now is a fight for so-called values voters. The Democrats hope to make inroads into those voters, and the Democrats have been busy retooling their religious rhetoric to appeal to heartland Christian voters. But what is more interesting to me is that we no longer have presidential candidates who have the opportunity to sit out religion, to declare it private. We no longer have presidential candidates who have the luxury of Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt basically to say nothing about it at all. That no longer seems possible. I think that's because everyone has to bow to the overwhelming influence of revivalist and evangelical styles in American religion and politics. Jefferson famously said in 1800, "We are all Federalists and we are all Republicans." Now it could be said that no matter what our personal beliefs, in some sense, we are all evangelicals. So that's my talk for today, and I wanted to leave plenty of time for questions and discussion because that's, I think, always the most interesting part of these. So thank you very much for your attention.